This is Michael Cohen, and you're listening to the Mea Culpa Podcast.
I'm just looking at it as a bonus. I don't have anything to prove. I don't have anything to win. And I have absolutely nothing to lose.
Today in America, great things are happening. Serena Williams is shining for perhaps the last time at the U.S. Open before evolving into a new career. NASA is preparing for the first moon launch in decades. President Biden's approval ratings have jumped to 44%, up from 38% in July. And today in America, Twitter is trending with hashtag Trump Meltdown. Yeah, hashtag Trump Meltdown. Why? Because splashed across every newspaper and broadcast in this great land is a salacious photo. A photo Trump certainly never wanted you to see, of top secret documents laid out on the floor of his Mar-a-Lago office like dead bodies that he forgot to bury.
Breaking news. The Justice Department today released this photo of the documents seized. You just saw it. In the raid on former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate, it showed several classified cover sheets. The Justice Department said it had uncovered efforts to obstruct its investigation into the discovery of those classified documents. It also said that government records were likely concealed and removed from a storage room at the property. Mr. Trump has insisted that he did nothing wrong.
Late Tuesday night, the DOJ released the photograph along with a damning 36-page filing that, amongst other things, claims that Trump lied, obstructed their investigation, mishandled classified documents, and attempted to conceal them from the National Archives, who had been struggling to retrieve for over a year and a half.
180 years of searching, and I'm 3 feet away. Of all the words written here about freedom, there's a line that's at the heart of all the others. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and provide new guards for their future security. People don't talk that way anymore.
This filing was in response to Trump's lawsuit last week requesting that a court-appointed special master review the material seized from a Mar-a-Lago by the FBI back in early August. But now, the DOJ contends that there is no special master needed because the documents don't belong to the former president and they never have. He's just a fucking idiot. He stole them, he hid them away, and then abused their significance by leaving them haphazardly around his stupid fucking country club, where just anyone could find them.
We've heard from all the reporting that Donald Trump believed that these documents were his. They belong to me. And that privacy argument we heard even last night from his attorneys. Well, Karl Rove was talking about that last night on Fox News. Here's what he said.
That's its own situation that the DOJ is investigating, and the Trump side has their lawyers and their feelings about what was rightfully right. His and able to take. But it's just interesting.
Let's be clear on this. None of these government documents are his to have taken. I agree with the deputy director who said that a lot of the former president's mm-hmm. problems are of his own creation. You can, under the Presidential Records Act of 1978, you cannot take original documents out of the White House with you when you leave the White House, whether you're the president of the United States or any of his aides.
But by concealing classified documents he professed not to have, he landed himself and the lawyers who vouched for him in scalding hot water. Despite a story that has changed more times than makes rational sense, Merrick Garland and the DOJ aren't backing off. Quite the opposite. And Trump is about to find out that the Attorney General is fuck a lot smarter than he is.
Donald Trump has to try to find a way to sleep knowing how very badly he misjudged Attorney General Merrick Garland.
What Trump was doing with the stolen documents remains to be seen. But it's Trump. He could have wanted them for any number of reasons. Posterity, extortion, blackmail, you name it. But he wasn't even a little worried about the lives that might be on the line or the positions that he was compromising. Or he would have given the documents back without the search warrant.
They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
But to Trump, Those documents represent his power, power over his enemies, and maybe even power over a certain French president that he was jealous of. Whatever the case, he didn't want to give them back. Like he didn't want to give back the presidency, or his executive powers, or Air Force One. No, he wanted to keep it all. But today, I'm betting that it's starting to sink in, that those things are gone and they ain't never coming back.
And if you broke the law, you can't say that. I'm not gonna, I already said you will pay. The demonstrators who infiltrated the Capitol have defied the seat of dust. It's defiled, right? See, I can't see it very well. But this election is now over. Congress has certified the results. I don't want to say the election's over. I just want to say Congress has certified the results without saying the election's over, okay?
All the stalling and bad lawyering in the world isn't going to make his case go away. In fact, he's compounded it by falsely claiming that the FBI planted the documents. And now you can hear that bullshit parroted all over right-wing news media. They've even got a new slogan, defund the FBI. And replace it with what? Jack boots? Brown shirts? In Trump's dictator fever dreams, all the cases against him are gone. He's more powerful than Putin. But in reality, even some of his old friends are starting to throw him under the bus. Based simply on his reading of last week's highly redacted FBI affidavit, Alan Dershowitz, yeah, Alan fucking Dershowitz, said there was currently enough evidence to indict the former president. And by Wednesday morning, even the gossip rags got in on the act. TMZ ran the headline, Mar-a-Lago raid, shocking photo of top secret docs. Trump kept some in his desk.
He had apparently three classified documents in his desk. And then the stuff, as Brian detailed on the floor, it shows five yellow folders marked top secret and another one with that says secret SCI, which means sensitive compartmentalized information. Those are the biggest secrets in the world. Why would he, and apparently the president, former president, went through them in January. Why wouldn't he say, oh, you know what? I really need to turn that back over. Why'd he have all that stuff at Mar-a-Lago?
Steve Doocy also went off on Trump Wednesday morning while on Fox and Friends, chatting it up with Trump's superfan, the dim-witted governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem. Doocy said, and I'm going to quote, ultimately, it comes down to why did he have all that secret stuff in Mar-a-Lago? But leave it to good old Kristi Noem to call black and white the FBI untrustworthy.
Well, that's why I think it's important that this is transparent and that we do have someone who's outside of the DOJ looking at this and talking to people. What is this information? We don't know what was in there. We don't know if, I believe President Trump declassified all this information. Let's find out really what the process is, what is right, what's precedent that other presidents have followed, and make sure that this is done correctly.
I don't think any governor, I don't think any president has ever carted off that many documents to their house.
Now, why would the DOJ want to share top secret documents with the public or Kristi Noem or any other fucking person? The agents who seized those documents had to get special clearance just to pick up the folders that they were in, just to touch them. And prosecutors argue that Trump's attorneys move too slowly and that it would be pointless to appoint a special master because investigators have already reviewed everything that was seized.
George Conway, why would Team Trump want this information out there? Why would they even ask for a special master knowing what the evidence is?
It's insane. They asked for the... They asked for the Justice Department to punch them in the face. And that's what the Justice Department did in this brief.
And did anyone ever believe the bullshit about Trump declassifying the documents? Even though no one had ever heard about it before the raid. And hello, you can't declassify stolen documents anyway. It's just another fucking lie Trump forgot to tell his lawyers. Or they would have mentioned it to the feds when they voluntarily turned over the first 15 boxes of documents back in January. Trump's lawyers will end up being witnesses in the case against him. Mark my words on that.
When you get fired in a movie, right, and every time someone leaves, they only have one box worth of their stuff. to take. It's that same box, right? It's that same box that was
pictured. It was there. Underneath my lamp, and I couldn't see it. That's the problem. I put the lamp in the box to carry out the lamp, and the picture of my kids, of course, and I put it in the box, and then I didn't see the top secret documents in there.
The Washington Post says the evidence laid out in Tuesday's filing could be enough to build a case around Trump's attorneys, Evan Corcoran and Christina Bob. They willingly obstructed the government's investigation into the documents at Mar-a-Lago. Lawyers for the government recounted numerous instances when they purposely misled government officials during the investigation.
But there are places on the internet where you'll find, let's say, dubious legal advice.
Trump has apparently hired a new lawyer after struggling for weeks to find anyone still willing to represent him. And why wouldn't they? He doesn't pay. So they bring on Chris Keyes, a former Solicitor General in Florida, who served as an advisor on Ron DeSantis' transition team. He signed a multi-million dollar deal to represent the former president. Now, me personally, I would tell him, make sure you get the money up front. According to Trump's team, he was given assurances that he would be taking a lead role in the case. Now, listen up, pal. Good luck. That's all I've got to say. Actually, no, wait. That and don't expect to ever get paid, ever.
And tonight, his life got much worse with the revelation in the New York Times that Donald Trump himself went through all of the boxes of documents that he was illegally possessing and concealing at his Florida home. And this is the kind of reporting that indicates that Donald Trump's legal life is going to get much, much worse as this story keeps moving forward.
That's why I'm telling you, take the money up front. And one last bit about the damn documents that I found interesting. According to the New York Times, during the transition from the White House, Trump had overseen the packing process himself with great secrecy, declining to show some items even to top aides, said a person familiar with the process. So, while other people may go down for Trump, at the end of the day, this is all on him.
It's a witch hunt, hoax.
The witch hunt.
It's a total witch hunt. Do you have these phony witch hunts?
Tuesday's DOJ filing makes one thing clear. The evidence of obstruction combined with the mishandling of classified documents should be enough to ban Trump from running or holding office ever again. And should you want to do a deeper dive on the Mar-a-Lago scandal, check out our special episode featuring legal expert Frank Figluzzi that dropped earlier this week. I mean, folks, it's a killer. And now for the main event. Today, we welcome to the show political analyst Zerlina Maxwell. Maxwell is the director of progressive programming at SiriusXM and a political analyst for MSNBC. She's had her own show called Zerlina on Peacock and was formerly the director of progressive media for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Maxwell is also a sought-after commentator, speaker, and writer. She writes and speaks about culture, gender inequality, sexual consent, racism, and similar topics from a liberal perspective. She describes herself as a survivor of sexual assault and a survivor activist. So catch her great daily show, Mornings with Zerlina, on XSM Progress. Now let's go now to that conversation. Okay, so Zerlina, we've talked about Trump and his standoff with the National Archives a lot. And Trump has, I mean, he's had sort of a win. I mean, in that this Florida judge has assigned a special master to look over the documents that he had in his possession. What do you think will have, what do you think having a special master will end up doing for him in this case? Because to me, it seems like just more stalling on Trump's part. But at the end of the day, how do you see this whole incident with Mar-a-Lago and the documents affecting his future? Not just, I'm talking about his potential incarceration, but I'm talking about his future for potentially running again. Is this the story that brings him down? Or do you think that we've moved on in a few weeks, that we'll just move on as we seem to have done just all too often.
Well, maybe the American public might move on. And first of all, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Maybe the American public will move on, but I don't think that any of the prosecutors at the Department of Justice will move on. I don't think that any of the people tasked with, you know, ensuring that our national security is protected will move on. I don't think that judges who are, you know, taking the time in this particular case to rule on these serious issues will just move on. One of the pieces of analysis that I just read was that the special master point may be moot just at this point because it's already, you know, the judges said that all these documents have already been gone through before and, you know, the privileged material had been set aside. But at the end of the day, when I think about what's happened here with the story, all these technical back and forth, what the court is ruling here, what the court is ruling there, what Donald Trump's defense is today, that is like besides the point. Basically, how I summarize the story is this. Donald Trump took documents. So just shorthand it with stuff. He took stuff. This morning I was sort of likening it to or comparing it to drugs. I was like, if you just instead of documents, just imagine it's drugs, and then it's easier to sort of figure out whether something went wrong here. But basically what he did is he took stuff to Mar-a-Lago that he was not allowed to take. And then when they told him that the stuff you took, sir, is illegal for you to have it, we need it back, he said, it's my stuff. It's mine. I don't want to give it back. And then, okay, here's a little bit of it back. I promise I gave you all of it. Again, illegal for him to have. And then there's a back and forth. That's what we saw in that affidavit that was released about trying, you know, with the government trying to get back the stuff that it was illegal for Donald Trump to have. And then they went and got the stuff. They went and got a search warrant. They had it approved at the court, and they went and got the stuff that it was illegal for Donald Trump to have. So he took the stuff. He had the stuff. He kept the stuff. All of those three things, illegal, illegal, illegal. Then he went back and forth with the government as they're trying to get their stuff back. And he lied to them during the investigation. They're claiming he obstructed their efforts to get that information back. And then they had to go take it back. I mean, I think that the fact pattern is very, very clear in a way that it hasn't been in some of the other criminal probes that Donald Trump has been a part of. And one of the things I always say is that, you know, sometimes the crime that you get sort of pinched on is the simpler one to prove. So maybe this is the one. I don't know. But I damn sure feel like there are a lot of people, black and brown and poor, in jail for a lot less.
Oh, that's listen, I was in jail and I spent time with many of these folks, some of whom, you know, were selling or transporting marijuana. And today, marijuana is legal. And the funny thing is these multinational companies are moving more marijuana in an hour than these guys are now doing 10, 15 years on. On top of that, with all due respect, and I've never smoked pot. I'm not a pot smoker. It's not my thing. One of the things that I understand is that it doesn't destroy national security. Now, it may make you want to eat a bag of fucking Doritos or something, or a box of Oreo cookies, but it's not going to fuck up the country, right, and put our national security in jeopardy. Now, I know it sounds funny, but your idea of transposing the terms documents for drugs, it's very appropriate because it's true. It is a real serious problem that so many people aren't really taking serious, especially not in the country. Where they're like, well, you know, they're only documents and he declassified them. I love the apologists for Trump. No, that's not what it's all about. First of all, in my case, there was a special master, Judge Wood, became the special mastermind. But I was looking through 10 million documents. Here we're looking through 184.
Right.
Because we don't need the love letters with Kim Jong-un. I'm sure they're very erotic and they're fascinating. Or the love letters with Vladimir Putin. Oh, you know, my Russian sweetheart. Stop. All right? We don't need any of that crap. Right. What we're looking for are the ones that were marked confidential, secret, and top secret. And interestingly enough, I'm not even sure, because there were, what, 25 documents
that paragraph 47 in the affidavit disclosed that were marked top secret. You know, there were some that are so top secret, it's only for the eyes of the person right. that actually wrote right. it. So how are you going to now allow a special master to take a look at this? What if these are nuclear codes or locations? You know, people don't understand. A special master is someone that gets appointed mm-hmm. by the judge in order to keep things moving, right? So that it's a neutral individual who's being asked to review highly sensitive documents. Well, these aren't like my documents right. between myself and Donald or, you know, Stormy Daniels or the lawyer for Stormy or whatever, Keith Davidson. Mm-hmm. This had nothing to do. We're talking about national security, top secret documents. And I'm not really sure that this individual or anybody for that matter should be looking at them. Just my opinion.
No, it's a really, really important point. And the other thing that you said this morning that's sort of been, I don't know, I'm probably gonna think about it when I don't sleep later, is when you said that one of the theories that you have about Donald Trump is that potentially he took this information and kept it because it's leverage for later, right? If he is prosecuted in one of these other criminal investigations, whether it be down in Georgia or the DOJ here in Washington, D.C., related to the insurrection, you know, maybe he could say, hey, guys, I have some nuclear codes that I will sell to someone or give to someone bad if you prosecute me. And that is going to bother me because I feel like that should sound implausible. But given what we know about Donald Trump and given what you know in your experience, it's not implausible. And I think that's the thing that's going to sort of stick with me. And the severity of what we're talking about here, and especially since you mentioned the nuclear codes, I mean, that's the level of seriousness. Like, that's where we are now. And the failure, I think, to hold Donald Trump accountable and all of these other opportunities, whether it be the Mueller probe or the first impeachment or the second impeachment, it feels to me like, you know, eventually the consequences are going to be irreversible if we continue to let him just get away with everything.
Yeah. And, you know, you and I was on your radio, your Sirius XM radio program this morning. And one of the things that, you know, I did say to you, and I still stand by it, is originally when I was on television, I think it was with Ari Melber or Allison Cameron. It was one of the two. I forget which one. I made a comment, which is, I think everyone's asking the wrong question. Not so much what were the documents. That's important. But I think the more important question that needs to be asked is, why was he keeping right. those documents?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the one that we have to all look at. And yeah, I stand by the fact, knowing Donald as I do, he will do anything in order to avoid responsibility, accountability. In that means throwing Alan Weisselberg under the bus, mm-hmm. which he's already done, despite Alan not realizing it in the Manhattan DA's case, or what will ultimately roll into the New York Attorney General mm-hmm. Tish James to her case, or the Georgia case where Rudy Caluti, drunken Giuliani, is going to learn very quickly what it feels like to get your ass run over by four wheels of a bus. On top of that, you got Mark Meadows now. Now you have Lindsey Graham, who's making all sorts of stupid comments. We're going to get to him in a little bit. But, you know, one of the things that scared me more than anything is a couple days ago in the Washington Post, Jacqueline Alemani wrote this article, which is called Inside Trump's War on National Archives, on the National Archives. And one of the things that it identified, and I didn't know this, is that Donald had actually taken scores of these classified records with him on trips. Mm-hmm. Now, again, it doesn't even take knowing Donald to realize what he's doing. He's going to use this as a get out of jail free card. He's going to use it and say to the government, no problem. You want to indict me? You want to incarcerate me? I have 20 supporters and you don't have no idea who they are. 20 supporters who have copies of these 184 documents, or even maybe just the 25 that are the top secret. You put my, you lock my ass up. My folks are instructed to ensure that these get into the hands of Putin, Kim Jong Un, right? Iran, right? This is Mohammed bin Salman. I mean, and we have no idea.
Right.
You and I, we will never ever know what those top secret, secret, confidential documents are. Truth be told, I don't even really want to know. Mm. I just want to know why he had it, and I want to know that he was not successful in showing it or giving it away, because our national security rests in those documents. And when I spoke the other day to Frank Figluzzi, and I also spoke to Norm Eisen about, you know, about this topic, both of them said the same thing. You don't realize the extent of the damage that 184 documents can do to the entire Justice Department and to the United States of America.
Well, I think that, you know, especially because the Justice Department decided to go to a judge and get a search warrant, it's pretty clear that they feel like the potential for damage was pretty high. I don't think they would have gone to these extreme measures if they didn't think that the damage to national security, you know, would be substantial. And then now we still have to figure that out. I mean, frankly, because, you know, they have to assess how much damage actually occurred here, if any. And that's really alarming. I mean, how could, I mean, maybe you understand this because you were on the inside, but like, I always sort of waited, I think, for the moment where the Republicans would be like, all right, I've seen enough. Like, he's gone too far. He has incited a whole insurrection and police have died. So now we should separate ourselves from Donald Trump. He has literally, you know, incited an insurrection that has resulted in the loss of law enforcement. They never have, though. And I mean, there was that brief moment the day of and the couple of days after. But obviously, you know, Kevin McCarthy went to Mar-a-Lago and changed his tune. But why do you think that is? I mean, what is it about him that draws people to him? I think that's my question. Like, what is it that makes people want to be around him, want to, you know, defend him in public? Like the charisma factor, like what is it about him?
You know, people don't realize that Trump is actually very charming when he wants to be. More than that, he actually makes you feel not just that you're important, but that you're right there with him. This isn't my fight. This is our fight, right? You know, he uses that. And basically, the thing in your mind, at least if you're a Lindsey Graham, a Kevin McCarthy, and all these other acolytes that are sitting around him and continuing to promote the big lie, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, the Ted Cruz's, they believe that he is the power right now in the RNC. They want to keep their seats, but they also want increased power. And their belief is that they are going to put their trust behind this buffoon, right? And that they're going to stay loyal to him so that they can achieve that power. If you saw the, you know, the Handmaid's Tale,
I
it's
did.
No different, right? With the, what's it, the admiral or the colonel, whoever, I forget, he's the top guy. And then you see all these folks that are around him. And sometimes, like in The Handmaid's Tale, you have to sort of throw your own family under the bus because that's how you retain power and the loyalty, which I'm pretty sure that Jared would be number one, followed by Don, Ivanka, Eric, etc. Melania would go before he would go. Rest assured.
Melania. You
know, remember when he cut off his wife's finger because she was reading the Bible, which was a violation. The same thing here. He will use anyone and everyone in order not to be held accountable. But then let me ask you this question. The Supreme Court's draconian abortion ban and all the states that have followed them down, you know, the woman-hating rabbit hole are turning people's lives upside down. Now, I'd go so far as to say that There's a real war on women and trans people in this country right now. And, you know, what brings up this question is our conversation with The Handmaid's Tale. And that The Handmaid's Tale, for instance, would be like a dream come true for some of these Republicans. I mean, short of the ballot box, how can women take their power back? I mean, what else can they do? And by the way, I'm saying go to the ballot box. I believe every single woman, Republican, Democrat, Independent, should be voting these assholes right out of office. You turn around and you agreed with this abortion ban, you know, fuck you, you're a goner.
I think a lot
No other way to say it.
No, I think a lot of women are saying that. I think if you go on TikTok right now, there is a you know, there are a lot of women on social media platforms right now expressing just how mad they are about that abortion ruling, about how they are basically like over men if they're heterosexual. And I think a lot about the fact that, one, women are going to go and make their voices heard. I think large groups of angry people have always changed the world throughout history at different points. Large groups of organized angry people, they change things. So large groups of angry women, they're going to change things. I mean, we went outside after Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 and we put on the pink hats, if everybody remembers. But what resulted from that march is people running for office. So you had more women elected in 2018 in the Congress, but also throughout the country in state legislatures. And then, you know, that sort of led us up to the point where you have a vice president that is a woman as well. So I think like we're making very, very small incremental progress. And the anger that was felt in 2016 after the election of Donald Trump, or, you know, him winning the Electoral College, you know, that was a moment where women were like, oh, crap, like the future that we sort of saw, the fact that women could be seen as equal, that women could be seen as the president or seen as somebody who could be in charge and be a leader. We still have a ways to go. I mean, one of the first thoughts I had in the Javits Center on election night in 2016 was like, maybe I was naive when I joined this campaign and thought we were just going to, the first woman to get the nomination was going to win, like just on one try. I mean, when in life do you ever have to try once to do something hard? We hadn't done it in hundreds of years. Why would we try once and they would win? I mean, I know Barack Obama did it, but he's a man. It's different. There's nuance to it.
Well, look, there are many things. Yes, there is definitely nuance to it. But the big problem here was not that Hillary Clinton was a woman. Hillary Clinton was the problem.
Well, I think
women hated Hillary Clinton.
But I think that, you know, the source of the hatred towards Hillary Clinton, and I thought a lot about this, like, because I didn't join the campaign. I worked for Barack Obama. So I didn't join the campaign in 2016 as somebody who like grew up. There were a lot of people there that grew up loving Hillary Clinton and thinking she was God. I joined the campaign respecting Hillary Clinton and thinking that she had the experience to be president. And I wanted to be a part of history, just like I was in 2008. And I think that her unpopularity, which is, I think, what you're referring to, like her approval ratings were very bad. So were Trump's. And that was like sort of the weird dynamic going into 2016. But like part of the problem was that a lot of the narratives created about Hillary Clinton, they started in 1990 in Arkansas when she was the first lady. And they asked her why she had continued to work as a lawyer. And she said to the person, well, I wasn't going to say I'm going to bake cookies. Like, I'm a lawyer, so I'm going to go work as a lawyer. And ever since that, also coupled with the fact that she did not at first take her husband's last name, that, I mean, she was already just on the wrong side. And then since that point, sort of had to work her way back to being trusted. Because immediately when she was like Hillary Rodham, you're like, oh, I don't trust her. She's not acting like her first
but
lady
she
should
never,
act.
She never got that. She never got that trust back. That was the big problem.
No. I don't think that she got it back.
Couple that with
I'm
all the nonsense.
That,
right.
I'm saying that was the source of why she lost it. And then it was very difficult to get it back. And I think in some ways it's a, I'm not saying that Hillary Clinton is perfect. I would never say that. But what I am saying is that having been inside of headquarters and just watching the coverage, right? And now I'm on the media side. So like I went from being inside watching the coverage to being on the outside covering campaigns. the level of sexism is like, it was crazy in 2016. And then we saw that sort of with the 2020 candidates as well. But I think she sort of paved the way for them to at least run more authentically as women than anybody had before, because she had done it and sort of
agreed,
you know, been attacked for you know, so long.
Agreed. But I think we also have to acknowledge that had anybody else run against Trump in 2016, the result would have been different. The problem that when I've spoken to both sides, I'm pretty sure of it.
I mean, I'm being completely honest with you. I do not know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that any woman could have beaten Donald Trump. I think that there was a lot of metrics, a lot of specific sort of things that happened. Like, in some ways, when I look back on it, like, I remember standing there the day after the election 2016 with Jess McIntosh, who sat next to me and was my, like, partner in crime and formerly hosted the radio show with me. And we stood there and we were just like, I think all of this shit happened because she's a woman. Like, I think Vladimir Putin hated her. Like, at the end of the day, because, like, she's a woman trying to, you know, like, there's a misogyny deep through all of this. A lot of the attacks on her specifically, maybe the specifics of the attack don't seem that way, but at the core of it is misogyny. The core of it is distrust.
I think the core of it was really just the whole Clinton machine, to be honest with you.
When the
information came out as well, you know, about how they started that fund, you know, the Clinton Foundation, to which 85% of every dollar raised, they had complete discretion over. Bad timing, bad move by all of them. And yet Donald keeps 90%.
No, but here's the thing.
But that's okay.
No, but here's the thing. What I'm saying is that, like, no person out here in public life is absolutely perfect, and, like, you couldn't critique them on any single thing. But I think one of the things that happened with Hillary Clinton is that there is a particular nastiness with which, I mean, like, I would just talk to, I mean, I'm just even saying anecdotally, people who are progressives would say to me, like, I don't know what it is. I just don't like her. I'd vote for Elizabeth Warren. And then Elizabeth Warren is standing in front of them. They're not voting for her either. And then I'm like, okay, well, I think that I figured out what's going on here. I don't think it has to do specifically with Hillary Clinton, even though people articulate and list out their reasons. I'm not saying, and again, like, we have already sort of gone through the fact that, like, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, right? So everybody can say, like, this is the reasons I don't like Hillary Clinton. But one of the things that I observed in 2020 is that a lot of those people that were like, I don't like Hillary. It's not because she's a woman, though, because I vote for Elizabeth Warren. When Elizabeth Warren was standing on the stage saying, vote for me, they wasn't voting for her then either. So I just, there's a lot of overlap. I would like to see
a female president. I think the country would be in a lot better shape than these,
yeah,
you know, these man babies, you know, like Donald and so on. So let me ask you this then, because you've referred to yourself as a survivor activist. Mm-hmm. Can you do me a favor and expand on what that term means? I don't know what that term means, and how you came to consider yourself a survivor activist.
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't know where it might say that on, like, my Wikipedia, and that's sort of a description that goes to the fact that I'm a survivor of sexual assault. So, and I've talked about my experience in public, so that when I say that I'm, you know, in a survivor activist, that means that I am willing to talk about what I have experienced in a public forum, and with all that entails, which is not always a fun situation, but I think it's important because I'm strong enough to do it. And I think I don't want anybody else to experience what I experienced. And so I can step forward and say, these are the things that we can improve upon. We can talk about consent. We can talk about, masculinity. We can talk about, the need to perhaps acculturate some young men and boys a little bit differently so that they view women as full human beings and people and treat them accordingly. So survivor activist is just someone who's sort of lived through a particular trauma, but has chosen to utilize that trauma and talk about the trauma so that it doesn't happen to anybody else.
So I guess I could call myself a survivor activist.
You are survivor activist. You survived solitary confinement. When you shared that experience, my heart aches That is a horrible experience. I don't want anybody to experience that. No one.
So one of the things people constantly, including the publisher of my book, Melville House, said to me when I gave them the manuscript to read, like, maybe we should tone down the attacks that you have on Otisville and the DOJ. And I said, bullshit, I'm not changing a single thing. Let me describe the cell the second time that they put me back in for another 15 days. And thanks to Danya Perry and Judge Alvin K. Hellerstein, you know, I was released. The cell that they put me in, actually the whole E building, the EA block of the A block of the E building is how it's described, was condemned. They had previously had the guys from MDC in there who destroyed it. My window was broken. And when I say broken, not that it wouldn't open or close. It was missing a piece of glass. So it was about 100 degrees outside. Remember, we're 3,500 feet yep. on top of up in the air, on top of the mountain. It was oppressively hot. There is no ventilation. Forget about air conditioning. There's right. no ventilation. The window's missing a piece of glass. At nighttime, when it would rain in on me. The bugs would all come in. All I did is ask for a piece of plastic and some duct and some tape. They refused to give it. You know, the toilet was broken. The sink was broken. The place was filthy. I mean, this is where you go, right? When you're, you know, when you're in the custody of the U.S. Department of Corrections, the Bureau of Prisons. And it's wrong. And, you know, that place should not have been utilized at all, forgetting about the fact that it was on the wrong side. It wasn't the satellite camp. It was the other side. But there's no movement. You don't go outside. It's not like you see in the movies that they're right. outside hanging out. And so this was pure solitary confinement, 24/7. I was in an 8x10 cell for 51 days. And you know what? It does change you. Mm-hmm. But let me move on so I don't sit there and, you know, make this all about me. But the book goes into it with great, great detail. So the poll numbers mm-hmm. may not reflect it, but Biden is on a roll at the moment, you know, getting a whole lot done for the country. Now, Kamala has also been tirelessly working for the country, but her numbers are even lower than Joe's, and she doesn't get press or any recognition for all the things that she's currently doing, the good things mm-hmm. that she's doing. Now, perhaps you'd give us your take on why you think that is.
We already talked about it. Sexism.
Well, let's talk about it again.
Reason. It's not the only reason. That's part of the reason. Part of the reason, and this is somebody who is, I am a member of the media. Every single person in the media gets the same email that I do from the vice president's office with a list every week about everything she's doing. All the media, all her appearances, all her travel, every press appearance, every clipping. We get that email every week. It is the choice of the person hosting a show to cover that. And to say this is what the vice president was doing. Now, most shows will cover what the president is doing. It may not find, you know, space in their hour to cover what the vice president is doing. I have on specific occasions started my show with what the vice president was doing, whether it be having a summit, the first ever in American history on Black maternal mortality, which has become extremely relevant now that abortion is illegal in this country. And Black women were already disproportionately dying in childbirth. My grandmother died in childbirth, so this is a super real thing for me. My mother almost died having me and my sister. So maternal mortality is something really close to my heart, and Kamala has taken that and championed that as an issue that she's focused on from day one. Now, could the men hosts cover it? Yep. Do they? Nope. Do I know why? Nope. So I think part of the reason is choices. Part of the reason is choices. They choose not to focus on the things that she's doing. Maybe they don't want to talk about Black maternal mortality. It's not an issue that is, you know, high on the priority list for them because it doesn't affect them. It's not seen as sort of horse race, you know, political gamesmanship or whatever that they like to focus on every day. But I do think that part of the problem is lack of diversity in our media, which would allow for at least different people to make the decisions about what to cover, what is covered, and how to cover it. That's part of it. The other part is, you know, I think that there is a sort of a balancing act she has to play where she's not the president. So, you know, I think, I don't know what Joe Biden's approval ratings were at any point compared to Barack Obama's, like, offhand, but I imagine they were similar or lower, or maybe a little higher, but like similar, because most people focus on what the president is doing and just associate everything the president is doing with what the vice president is doing, even though in some instances, and this was actually true about the Obama administration. I remember when Joe Biden went on the Sunday show, was like, gay marriage should be legal. And everybody was like, what? So there are moments where the vice president can sort of step forward and take a more commanding role on an issue. But I think that she is playing a supportive role. She's the first person from her background, woman, black and Indian woman, who is in that position. So I don't necessarily say like what she's doing is the right way or the wrong way, because we don't know. We never lived through it before. So I just think that what I like is that every week I get a detailed list of everything that she's done. And I think it's the choice of the people that work in the media to cover that or not. And if the American public's not hearing about that, and maybe that's not registering in her approval, that is partially the media, but also maybe they can find more creative ways to communicate mm-hmm. it, and they don't have to work through our filter.
Right. I mean, certainly, you know, she has press office and they should be out there touting her accomplishments. I get offended by people because they know my stance. They know my position. I've been a Democrat my entire life. In fact, in 1987, I worked for Congressman Joe Moakley, you know, in the Capitol. A wonderful, wonderful man from Massachusetts. I really enjoyed that, you know, that year and a half, you know, working at that office. But I've had a chance to meet Kamala when I was testifying before both the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that she sat on, as well as when I was testifying before the House Oversight Committee. And I'll tell you, she's a wonderful person to meet one-on-one. She's a wonderful person. And I hear from people, I don't like her. She lies. She flip-flops. She does, you know, you can't believe anything that comes out of her mouth.
Are they ever able to point to any example?
No, that's the point, Zelina, I was going to make. Yeah. So I said, what did she say that you find so offensive? Right? You know,
yeah.
First of all, I dig her because she's married to a Jewish guy. Right? You Doug know, is it's the first.
He seems it's really the, nice. Sure. I don't know Doug, but I just see
him. He does,
cool.
doesn't he?
Seems
like
cool.
The kind of guy that you would go hang out.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'd like to go hang out with him at like a pool or something, you know, and just shoot the shit for a while. He seems like a nice guy. But I then say the same thing. What is it that she said today, yesterday, whenever, that offends you? Well, a lot of people don't like her because she was a prosecutor, right? Now she's flip-flopped on the whole country's flip-flopped on drugs, on, you know, marijuana and other sorts of drugs, decriminalizing them. You know, what it's so easy just to blame everyone. But if I'm going to blame anybody for the poor numbers that she has, I hate to say it, I blame her office in terms of the PR, and I blame the DNC, and I blame you know, Jamie Harrison a lot on this show, right? I believe that Democrats
are missing. He's a very nice person. Have you had him on? Have you tried?
By the way, no, I have not. But super nice guy. No, don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about as a person.
No, I understand.
I'm talking
nothing's
about
personal
as
on this.
Far as doing the job. Republicans are messaging 24/7. As Democrats, we don't message right.
Well, do you think that part of the reason why they're able to do that, and I've thought a lot about this, and as somebody who I host a morning show on Progress, but I am also the director of progressive programming. So when I started at Sirius, it was trying to figure out how to have a progressive channel, to have a progressive platform. How can we help to amplify? How can a channel help to communicate the message in the same exact way that the conservative channel, literally one of the other channels on Sirius, how they are able to do it? How is it that conservative radio and conservative media works as an amplifying bullhorn for the message, whereas the Democrats obviously have to work through the filter of the mainstream media because there really isn't progressive media dedicated just to the left? And I think that one of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons. One of the main reasons is because there's less lying There's just less flat out lying. It's a lot easier to come up with a message that's coherent, that's easy to remember, easy to repeat, when you don't have to worry about nuance and complicated facts and all the details. So I do think that, because I used to do a lot of debates on Fox News, and I was always struck by the fact that, oh, you're like, your job is so much easier than mine, you know, on the other side of the debate, because you don't have to work within the parameters of like factual information. You just say stuff like, you know, I remember one time I was in a segment and one of the anti-choice people was like, Plan B is an abort efficient. Like, so just set that sentence on TV. Nobody says like, hey, that's not true. That's not science. That's actually it's a whole different chemical than what you're thinking. It's right. Not actually like it's all it's not. No, like my dad's a biologist. Literally what you are saying is not true. But I think that a lot of the time in the mainstream media even is spent debunking some of the lies instead of just talking about the issues and doing the analysis of the impact.
I wish Jamie would, in all fairness, I wish Jamie would give me a call and I will teach him the Donald Trump methodology for Democrats.
No, I mean, if they were really smart, they would.
I appreciate that. Let me give you an example. This fucking ass clown, Lindsey Graham, comes out and he's now warning of riots in the street if Trump is prosecuted. Where's the Democratic message on that?
That's a really good question.
Let me tell you what Lindsey Graham is doing. That saggy old schmuck and a half. What is he doing? He's carrying Donald Trump's water to the people, stirring up shit, basically putting into the mind, and I had Jason Van Tattenhove on the show, right? Exactly what Donald wants him to do, to put into their mind that if in fact that he gets indicted, if in fact he gets prosecuted, forget about the fact that he has the national security secrets that he's going to try to use as a get out of jail free card. He wants these people, like on January 6th, armed and ready. Remember the famous words, stand by. And you know, right. Stand back and stand by. That's what Donald Trump is doing. So the fact that Democrats, that you and I and everybody else, and I consider mea culpa to be, you know, we'll call us progressive, right? I would say that I'm slightly left of center. Mm-hmm. I'm far from, you know, a Bernie Sanders, you know, but I'm probably slightly left of center. This needs an immediate response. Mm-hmm. And when I say an immediate response, I mean one so visceral, so deep down into the dog shit of the dumpster that, you know, a fool like Lindsey Graham will probably not run again because he'd be too embarrassed to show his face. That's what we need to do. They keep making these mistakes. They keep giving us all the fodder and all the ammunition, like the Roe v. Wade decision, right? Where's the big message? This is Donald Trump. This is the Federalist Society. This is the Southern White Christian Coalition. Right. Now, you, right, you, Zerlina, you're not part of that Southern White Christian Coalition.
No.
Michael Cohen from New York, neither am I. If you look like you, if you look like me, if you are not a member of that, vote against them, right? Why? So if we could control the House, the Senate, and the White House, you know what maybe we do? Maybe we actually manage to get something passed so that way, you know, instead of having the number of jurors that we have on the Supreme Court, maybe we add the five additional. Mm-hmm. And then we make these three irrelevant, or four, because you also have Thomas on there who's just, or Alito. I mean,
it's gonna be a while before we need more people
on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Like I said to you, that's my take. So let me ask you this then. What do you think are the main issues going into November? Because many of us are worried because certain states have made it harder to vote and marginalized whole communities. So in your opinion, who are the people, places, and issues progressives should be most focused on right now, considering we're, 70-some-odd days away?
I mean, I think they need to focus on the people that have voted for Democrats and even the people that just voted for Democrats in 2020. That's really what you need to do. You need to go get those people and you need to get them to go vote again. And you need to get the people who maybe they voted in the previous cycle and didn't vote in 2020, and you need to find them and you get them to. It's all about turnout, literally nothing else. I mean, the message is important, but my first job in politics was a field organizer, and I always go back to that because honestly, it is the most impactful job on a campaign. I had a job on a campaign where I worked in headquarters and I worked in the communications department, and we, you know, it's almost like West Wing-ish, like, you know, like you feel like you're sort of, this is what it's like to be on a campaign and you're having those strategy meetings and you think you're really important and you're impacting the vote. Do you know how many filters are in between what you decide in a meeting and an actual voter? A lot. There's
on
like
the Trump campaign, none.
Right. No, but I think that was one of the benefits that you had on your campaign, is that there was no filters in between you and what the voters are hearing. And so I think that a lot of what the Democratic strategy needs to be is it's not about the message. I actually had that epiphany a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, you know what? I don't think they could come up with like one, you know, slogan that's going to do it. They need to get people. They need to hire as many on the ground organizers as possible to educate people about the changes in the state laws around voting, register those people to vote, and get them to the freaking polls. It's like, it's not rocket science at this point, because now we're already in, about to be in September. There's a lot there, you know, like if people need to be persuaded to come out and vote against Republicans at this point after an insurrection has taken place and they have defended that insurrection, I don't know what to tell those people. But I feel like the majority of the American public does not need to be persuaded. All you need to do is make sure that they get out and freaking vote. And that's organizing. That's not messaging.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Then let me ask you this then, right? Because you've worked with some of the most powerful voices in progressive politics, right? Hillary, with Barack Obama. Did you ever imagine that Trump would do as much damage to civil rights and the progressive movement as he has? And to what degree do you think that Trump's election was in reaction to a black president and a female secretary of state? I mean, do you feel like it's going to take years to fix the damage that's been done? And if hypothetically we keep the House and the Senate in November, is there a chance that Washington can fix what's even broken?
It's a big question because it's one I think a lot about.
Yes.
Malcolm Nance, I know you know him. He says this is the last election potentially, and I have to agree with him. I think that if we don't try to work to save the democracy, it will continue to disintegrate before our very eyes. And that means that if they do elect a majority of Republicans in the House of Representatives, and they are like, we're going to impeach Kamala Harris because she's black. I mean, it'll come up with a reason, but it'll really be just because she's black and a woman. I mean, how dare she try to be in charge with. looking like a woman and being black at the same time. How dare. But I think that the damage that, and I felt this since election night. Again, I told you on election night 2016, I had a couple of different thoughts. One was, did we really think we were going to nominate the first woman and she was going to win? So I was like, maybe I was a little naive. I've lived my entire life as a woman. I know deeply how impactful misogyny is.
Congratulations on that.
No, I mean, the fact that I'm alive and still here, a lot of women can't say that, which is not a funny joke, but also, haha. But I think that, you know, there's a couple of different things. It's like, on election night, one of the first people I talked to was my dad. And both my parents have lived through, they're in their 60s, they lived through the civil rights era, were born in the 50s, you know, up teenage years, sort of in the height of the civil rights era, 1968 election, all that. And my dad said on election night 2016, ooh, this, I'm not going to see, like, I'm not going to be here for when we have fixed the damage that Donald Trump has done. And this before anything had ever happened. Like, the election had just happened. They just called. I think I might have even been in the taxi cab on the way from the Javits Center when they sort of, you know, got that notification that Donald Trump was the winner of the election. Like, they officially called it for Donald Trump. My dad said, I will not be alive when the damage of this is fixed. That's how much it's going to be. I think he underestimated it. I think it's more. I think it's worse. It's not just his lifetime. It's my lifetime, your lifetime. Just think about COVID alone. The reason why, I mean, I have a lot of critiques about the Biden administration when it comes to COVID-19 and, you know, the funding for vaccines, obviously that's Congress, but just the CDC messaging, obviously not great. But all of that goes back to the beginning of this pandemic, and a million people died, a million who will never come back. So will the damage of this presidency and the insurrection and all those things, will it be fixed? I don't know, because none of those people are coming back. None of them. Their family members are never going to talk to them again. That is a horrible thought. I mean, imagine you're somebody whose mother and father died. That's happened a lot in the pandemic, where people are losing both of their parents at the same time. Both their brother and my aunt lost her brother and her sister and her mother in the beginning of this pandemic. You can't recover from that. I mean, I don't think that you are, you know, the same again. You may recover and become different and evolve, but no, I don't think you repair the damage. I don't think it's repairable.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because my father came to the same conclusion as your father, of course, though, at different times. Mm-hmm. Like my father, who I had introduced Trump to on a multitude of occasions, didn't think or didn't see Trump as being this fascist authoritarian that he turned out
to
be.
Do you think he's fascist? I don't know if you know. We had a whole week of fascism experts.
The answer is yes.
They said yes. Yeah, that said yes.
I do believe so. My father lived through that. You know, my father's a Holocaust survivor. And so, you know, what is happening, not just to me, that's upset him, something fierce. But what's happening to this country, because my father always looked at this country with rose-colored glasses, the land of opportunity. Where can, you know, a guy who ended up going to medical school in Toronto because he wasn't offered to stay in the United States after the war, comes to teach head and neck reconstructive surgery here in New York, right? And then ends up meeting my mom, married, four kids, all become lawyers. One becomes a felon, disbarred lawyer. But my father will forgive me one day for that. My point is, we're no longer the country that we used to be.
Yeah.
You know, we were moving in the right direction. And then this fucking asshole comes along and throws everything, just puts us back. Like you were talking about the pink pussy hat, marches all over. The whole purpose of that movement was to enlighten the country about women's rights.
No,
what do they do? The first thing they do is they overturn a 50-year case of Roe v. Wade. And who knows what's next with this crazy bunch of people?
No, I mean, when folks were sort of warning that we could be headed towards the Handmaid's Tale, like, we weren't joking. I think a lot of people took it a little bit too literally, in the sense that they were like, oh, it'll be just like the Handmaid's Tale and, like, you'll have to wear the red outfit. I was like, first of all, the whole country is not going to be Gilead, but Alabama will be Gilead. It will be just like Gilead, just like that. They will be jailing women and mm-hmm. doctors for attempting to get medical care. I mean, and it's not abortion is health care. And the reason I say that is, like, for so long, you know, people on the left said that as sort of a talking point without explaining what they mean. But now that we have seen women, you know, a woman walking around with a dead fetus inside of her body because the doctor doesn't want to remove it because they're afraid they will be held legally.
Or a 10-year-old who gets raped. A 15-year-old.
Exactly.
Right.
So now we're sort of all coming around to the idea that abortion is healthcare, because when you don't have access to the healthcare that you need when there's an emergency, The result is you get sick and perhaps you die. Those are the consequences. Yeah. It's not
they don't care.
They don't care. But, well, that's the important point.
Long as their Southern white Christian coalition values are being upheld. But I wanted to ask you this question because we were talking about, you know, you did a whole thing on fascists and so on. Republicans obviously don't like to be called fascists.
No, of course not.
But every single one of them voted against removing Nazis and white supremacists. Personnel from the U.S. military. Mm-hmm. Now, they voted against voter rights. Viktor Orban was invited to speak at CPAC. I mean, MAGA is a white nationalist movement, so their ties to fascism are they're impossible to deny. In your opinion, is our democracy on the line now, and what are the consequences if we actually lose in November, like people are predicting?
I don't know. I'm really scared. I'm really scared about if the Democrats are not able to maintain majorities in November, because I definitely think that they are going to attempt to impeach Joe Biden for, it could be any reason. They'll just make one up at this point, because obviously Donald Trump was impeached twice for legitimate reasons, but they will just do it in terms of retribution. Then I also sort of have this weird picture in my mind of, like, even if Donald Trump doesn't run for president, him showing up to try to be the Speaker of the House or some crazy shit to reign over the impeachment of Joe Biden or some, you know what I mean, like, just make that a reality show, and then I'm just gonna have to leave. I'm going to have to move to the woods if that's the case, because I don't think I'll be able to. I'll just come back later. I don't know if I can fight in the revolution just yet. I'm gonna have to go get some resolve, because I'm very tired. But I do think that, so the danger here is that we lose the democracy without realizing it. The danger here is that we picture fascism as high-stepping military in the street, you know, with a tank. And that is not what it's going to look like here, not at first. It may eventually, but at first it will just look like close elections where it looks like there was some fraud or some cheating, but we can't prove it. Or voter disenfranchisement because of legal voter suppression that has changed laws in states where those elections are very close. And the people that are impacted the most by those changes in laws are just coincidentally Black and brown people. Like in Mississippi, where they upheld a law from 1890 just now that was intentionally passed in Mississippi to disenfranchise Black people. It's the felons voting law in Mississippi. From 1890. So for me, I feel like there is a danger of the descent to authoritarianism if the Democrats do not keep both of the chambers of Congress. But I think the bigger question for me is, I think that while there is a threat of a violent response, if somebody prosecutes Donald Trump, that's actually the only mechanism through which we can defuse some of this. He has to be prosecuted. He has to be held accountable for violations of the law that are provable. And they have to make an attempt. I'm tired of, like, the debate over whether he violated all these laws when we have, like, you know, books and books written about how he's violated laws. And, you know,
I mean, then you get the pundits on every single day
saying he's going to jail.
We're talking about law professors.
He's at home.
Right. And, you know, chowing down on his Mar-a-Lardo burgers with, you know, 2 gallons of ice cream. Now, look, Zelina, I understand why you would be tired, because you're a consummate journalist. You have that 2-hour news show 5 days a week on Sirius XM. So it's understandable that you're tired, right?
I'm not a morning person either.
It's gotta be incredible.
They gave me a morning show and I was like, oh, Lord, I'm going to have to wake up at 6. This is going to be hard.
You just go sleep earlier.
Yeah, it's
now,
true.
That's got to be an incredible amount of work for you, because every show has its own style and its own audience. But if you would, describe for my listeners what your show is all about. Because I understand you sometimes interview your father, mm-hmm. whom I understand is exceptionally funny, kind of like me, right? But it's also hard news. So what's the style of your show, and who are you trying to, and who are you actually reaching?
So I would say the style of my show. I mean, it's an iteration of the show that I did with my colleague from the Hillary campaign, Jess McIntosh. You know, but now that it's just me, it's my voice. And my nickname as a child, this is my dad's nickname for me, was Little Miss Question. So that's what I do. I ask questions about everything all the time. I've always been that way since I was little. I always wanted to know what was going on, where we were going, who's that person, why are they there? And so that just applies to everything now because, you know, effectively, I am somebody who's very curious. Curiosity sort of drives me. And so that's how I approach the show. I want to come hand, you know, with a list of questions. And I think that they're the most pertinent ones that all the listeners are trying to figure out for themselves. And I'm going to bring on the voices, the people, the analysts, the lawyers, the experts that can help, dare I say, unconfuse people about what's going on in the world. Yes, it has a lefty point of view. Yes, it is something that, you know, has a perspective. I am not shy about that. I, you know, where I've worked and who I've worked for is completely public information. But I'm also not somebody who shies away from people who disagree. I mean, I have people call all the time that like are like, well, I was listening to the Patriot Channel and you just flipped over. So, you know, I have a lot of those folks. And my rule is I don't raise my blood pressure for anybody because consequences of high blood pressure are very serious. And I want people to get smarter, more aware, and a little bit more empathetic. The other part of my show that I think is important, it has an explicitly intersectional feminist point of view. And the reason for that is because I think that that lens makes you more empathetic. It makes you more compassionate. It makes you more kind. It makes you understand sort of what's going on in the world a little bit better. So for me, I think it's a place where people can figure out what's happening in the world, figure out how it affects them, figure out why it matters. And when we identify problems, we throw out solutions and ideas and analysis of how we can fix it and make it better. And I feel like the show is still very much evolving because this iteration of the show without Jess is still in its first 3 months or 6 months. but I think that I may be the only feminist morning show in the United States of America. That's bad. In 2022. But that's what we're doing.
You know, especially if you have people like Lindsey Graham calling for civil war, right? I mean, who do they go after? They go after the easy pickings. They go after, you know, people like myself, you know, people who have name recognition like yourself. But Zerlina, let me say, the hour goes by very quickly on mea culpa. You believe it?
It's so fast. I was just looking at my phone because I'm getting a text on my phone. So I was like, done?
Tell them not to text you. Tell them not to text you because I have one last question for you. Okay. So it's clear that cable news is shifting. CNN has a new boss and a new direction that's supposedly moving towards the center. Now, I'm not sure what that means really for the rest of cable news. I mean, Fox has the lion's share of evening viewers, but they're more entertainment-based, and I'm not even sure how they can call what they do news. In fact, Sean Hannity turned around himself and said, I'm not a journalist, right? I'm a talk show host. But you work primarily at MSNBC and Peacock, which is considered more to the left, and your expertise is in the progressive media. Would you say that anyone these days is able to report the news without bias? I mean, the truth isn't supposed to be negotiable. Facts are facts.
Mm-hmm. Well, so one of the things I think a lot about is the fact that, you know, in progressive media, I wouldn't use the word bias, right? I have a perspective. I'm not shying away from the fact that I believe certain things, right? Like I believe women are people. That if that makes me like biased, okay. And by the way, that's one of the simplest definitions of feminism. Feminist means you believe women are people. so it's a thing where, you know, certain beliefs within media are seen as objective, and others are seen as you have bias. So I think that it depends what it is. And I think it's important for us to stick to the facts. So while I have a perspective on certain issues, I'm never going to say things that are that don't align with the facts. I'm always going to align with the facts.
Okay, but a fact is a fact, right? Let's
right,
just say
like the fact is
one
a fact.
Plus one. One plus one will always equal two. It's a fact, right? The sun rises and the sun sets each and every day. That's a fact. There's no such thing as alternative facts. Now, you can have your opinion, and I respect everybody's mm-hmm. opinion, so long as it's predicated on fact, right? And that's not what Fox is doing. When you start seeing the nonsense that's being spewed by the Josh Hawleys, the Matt Gaetzes, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, Trump, Ted Cruz, I mean, just the whole group of them, Mark Meadows, Jim Jordan, now Lindsey Graham, that's not facts. And when you present them with the facts, the first thing they turn around, they tell you, no, you have it wrong. Well, then show me where right. I'm wrong. But they can't do that.
No.
How do you combat? You know, my grandma used to always say, you can't argue with stupid. Mm. That's the problem. The Democrats have taken this position that you can't argue with stupid. And so we're just not arguing at all. And we're allowing them to control their fake message day in and day out. And it's troubling. It's really troubling. It's troubling for the party. It's troubling for the elections, both midterm and general.
Well, I think there is some truth to the fact that there is something on the Democratic side that means that they don't want to get in, you know, get in the dirt. They don't want to get in the mud. They don't want to fight. You know, they want to sort of be above the fray. And I understand that impulse. I understand it. But I think that I'm not saying you get in the mud, and I'm not saying that anybody should fight, because obviously I am opposed to violence in all situations. But I think that Democrats can show that they're willing to be loud, right? And in some instances, you know, the fight has to do with your point earlier, which is, where is Jamie Harrison? Where are some of these louder Democratic or bigger Democratic leaders, and why are they not being louder on some of these issues and about the threats to democracy? Now, some of them are. I think some of them really, really are. Some of them are.
Who?
Eric Swalwell. Very good. I think more people should talk
great
like Eric
guy.
Swalwell.
Great guy. I wish he would run for president. Yeah, like, I told him that about 2 weeks ago.
No. I mean, and he did before. But I think that the most important thing in this moment is that we all can do just a little bit of something. So while I look and say Jamie Harrison could be doing more, and when I say the media could be doing more, or X person in this organization could be doing more, every single voter in America needs to ask themselves, what are you doing? What did you do today to save democracy? Did you call five people? Did you text five people to make sure that they are registered to vote? Did you check your own registration to make sure your registration has not expired or changed in any capacity, your address doesn't change? Because that happens too in any state, mm-hmm. even if they're not trying to do anything nefarious. So instead of saying, how could the message change, or what should the party infrastructure be doing? I think one of the things in this election cycle we all need to do is take responsibilities as individuals and as voters and say, what could we do? Because I don't want to, one of the reasons I worked on the campaign in 2008, I did not want to have that election go by and have a Democrat lose and say, oh, I wish I could have done more, or I wish I would have done XYZ. I wanted to be able to complain and say, well, I did everything. It's not my fault. kind of like how I do now.
Fair
no,
enough.
I'm just kidding.
yep.
but I think it's really important for all of us to sort of become organizers in our own families, our
and
own
I
communities.
And I still believe, and I'll end it on that, that Jamie Harrison, the DNC, we should be putting on conventions like CPAC. We should have a DPAC. You get the Jamie Raskins up there, the mm-hmm. Eric Swalwells. You get the whole, get Hillary to come in there. Mm-hmm. Get former President Obama to come up there. You know, fight. If we're gonna fight for democracy, there's no better time to do it now. But Zerlina, let me thank you for joining
thank
me.
You.
You know, like I said, the hour goes by. I could talk to you for two more hours.
Well, I mean,
appreciate
my job
you
is
coming
talking,
on.
So I tend my. Most people have to tell me to be quiet, because They said, I'm always, my dad says I'm Little Miss Question and I have the gift of gab. So he's like, you're in the right job. Thank God for that.
Well, thank God that's right for radio.
But I do interview my dad because he's a biologist. That's why he ends up on my show on Fridays. He's who's kept me alive and COVID free. His advice. And so have him on because he can explain it way better than I can.
I'm sure he can, and me as well. Yeah. But Zelina, thank you so much for joining me. I'll definitely be speaking to you, and I'll definitely be seeing you again soon.
Thank you so much. Stay safe.
You too. And now for today's mea culpa. It's all very convenient for Republicans to blame anyone but Trump for his crimes. I mean, the MAGA voters still love him, and God knows they don't want to lose MAGA voters. Who would be left to vote Republican? A handful of old people and maybe Elon Musk? But to scapegoat the DOJ and the FBI to get Trump off the hook, it's just simply inexcusable. The fact is, they no longer give a shit about law and order. I mean, in fact, maybe they never did. I'll remind you that a Republican pardoned Nixon while Democrats impeached Trump twice. Democrats are the party of law and order. I'll say it all the time, but it's true and totally maddening. Trump has committed innumerable crimes and always manages to get away with it. But look at Trump's people, the early bad hombres like Manafort, Stone, and Bannon. Who looks at these three stooges and thinks, oh yeah, fuck, I trust these guys? No one. No one but MAGAs. And remember, the former Interior Secretary who rode in on a White House horse, Ryan Zinke? He recently used his position in government to screw some Native Americans out of their gaming rights, but he also wasn't indicted. Zinke slammed the investigation as a political hit job by the Biden administration. But the inspector who oversaw the investigation was appointed by Trump, and Zinke was fucking guilty of sin. But he didn't go to jail like he should have, and he's still favored to win a Montana House seat. I guess MAGAs love lawless blowhards, but what really happens when politicians commit crimes they don't pay for is resignation. And when law enforcement lets those politicians slide, we resign ourselves to being victims of the system, and that's just how it goes. Politicians have always been dirty. Whoa, but that's bullshit. Not all politicians are criminals, just most of them happen to be Republicans. Now, I'm only sort of joking, but it's true. But I read the other day, and it rang true, that the law exists for all of us. To act otherwise causes a loss of faith in our democracy. And sometimes, I wonder if that's what Republicans are trying to do. Crime in plain sight so that we give up. Look the other way. Accept it. And then, before we know it, the democracy is gone. But what if we just stop taking it? Call out the lies in real time. Call out the criminals and call out the crimes. George Clooney has a documentary coming out in September about Jim Jordan and the Ohio State sexual abuse scandal that he tried to cover up. I mean, finally, that's a step in the right direction. Fantasy filmmaker Dinesh D'Souza was set to publish the book version of his debunked 2000 Mules until the publisher issued a recall on the eve of the book's release. So sorry, fucking Dinesh, it ain't gonna happen. I know justice comes in many forms, but democracy won't survive the lawlessness of our politicians without law enforcement. I, for one, support Merrick Garland and the DOJ as they investigate Trump, come what may. I don't care if Republicans threaten riots in the streets. I don't care if it's political or inconvenient. I care about the rule of law, and I'm sure you do too. And thanks for listening. Mea Culpa is brought to you by Audio Up, Midas Touch, and LSJ Media, written by Jimmy Jelinek and Paula Killen. Our editor and managing producer is Lisa Orkin. Our executive producers are Jared Gustad, Jimmy Jelinek, and myself, Michael Cohen, along with Phil Alberstadt. It may be a new day politically, but nowadays the landscape is more confusing than ever. Donald Trump may have lost the battle for the presidency, but in many ways, Trumpism is still winning the war on the state and local level. Mea Culpa's here to help guide you through the wilderness and keep you informed. And let's face it, we all want Trump, Rudy, and the rest of these seditious traitors to see justice. And folks, I promise you, it's coming. So stay tuned as I guide you through the twists and turns of the criminal process that will ultimately see them behind bars. Mea Culpa, nothing but the truth.